And welcome back. We heard from the challenger in Illinois' 12th District Congressional race earlier. That was Mike Bost. That was in the first segment of the program. Incumbent Democrat Bill Enyard is next. He's a first-term congressman and former adjutant general of the Illinois National Guard. In Congress, he serves on the U.S. House Armed Services Committee and the U.S. House Committee on Agriculture. Congressman, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, Don, thanks for inviting me. It's great to be back with you again.
I'd like to start with you, as I did with Mr. Bost, about that ad. Everybody has been talking about that. You know the one I'm speaking of. He said that that thing is backfiring on you and that, in fact, it is flattering because it shows just how passionate he is about things.
Well, Don, you know, the if folks watched the debate last week, I think Paula Bradshaw, the third-party challenger, probably put it better than anybody else did. And she, when she talked about when a two-year-old has a tantrum, you send him to the corner, not to the Capitol. But I think, you know, when you talk about attack ads, that's actual video footage. It's not doctored. It's not phonied up. It's live tape. And if I were Mike Bost, I'd certainly try to diminish it too. But I think it shows a pattern of behavior.
All right. Well, let's move on to some other things. What do you think are the most pressing issues facing your district?
Well, Don, I think that the economy has certainly been on everyone's mind for the last several years, and the good news is that the economy is improving. You know, the unemployment rate nationally is down to 5.9%. Headline in the Belleville News Democrat last week, unemployment's down 2 points in St. Clair County over a year ago. I was over in Mount Vernon and Jefferson County a couple of weeks ago, and the mayor there, Mary Jane Chesley, had to show me very proudly the front page of the Mount Vernon paper, and unemployment is down in Mount Vernon a point and a half over a year. So we're certainly making some great strides, and I got to tell you, when I filled up with gas this morning in Shiloh, and it was $2.97, I was really tickled. I was a little aggravated because I should have filled up in Belleville where it was $2.95. But gas is below $3 a gallon. So I think things are moving in the right direction. Now, having said that, though, you know, we've certainly got plenty of problems still. We have very high unemployment in some parts of the district, some parts particularly, if you take a look at Jackson County, which is Mr. Boss' home county, he lives in Murfreesboro, that has the highest unemployment of any county in the state. I think maybe he needs to explain to his constituents down there why the highest unemployment in the state is in Jackson County.
Let's take a look at East St. Louis. We want to talk about unemployment and poverty. You know, what can you do as a congressman representing that district to alleviate the situation there for these people?
Well, you know, Don, in the debate, I had a kind of a mantra or a theme, and that theme was promises, performance. It's easy for a politician to make promises. It's a lot harder for a politician to show the performance. Mm-hmm. So what I ask voters to do in this election is take a look at promises and then look at performance. And what I have done in terms of performance, I've introduced a couple of acts, the WORK Act and the JOBS Act, each of which increase employment, and they do it through a very simple way, particularly the WORK Act. It provides a grant to our community colleges for up to $2,000 for up to 2 years for unemployed or underemployed workers to retrain. You know, as I've gone around the district, and I've met with employers, I've met with workers, I've met with all sorts of folks, and consistently, particularly in the Metro East and in the corridor that's developing along Interstate 57 from Mount Vernon south to Marion, when I talk to employers, the biggest concern they have is getting trained, qualified employees. And I had a meeting in Granite City a couple of weeks ago, and the employer said, I could hire 50 welders tomorrow. tomorrow. But he needs some training. He doesn't have a training program. So we have worked with Southwestern Illinois College and the other community colleges throughout the district in order to ensure that these training programs are moving forward.
What is the status of your act, the legislation you proposed?
That's still pending in the House. It's still pending.
Well, I ask that because a lot of stuff is still pending in the Congress, and a lot of people are really ticked off at you ladies and gentlemen there for inability to get so many things done. How do you defend that?
Well, I just got elected to Congress. I've been there for about 21 months, and it's unfortunate that Speaker Boehner controls the agenda and refuses to allow so many Democratic-sponsored bills or amendments to even get a debate. And frankly, what we need to see it would be the Speaker, Republican John Boehner, to allow these bills to come up for a straight up and down vote. And, you know, he has adopted this policy that he will only allow legislation to come to the floor if he can pass that legislation with Republican votes. He doesn't want to pass anything with Democratic votes. But I can tell you, and let's take a really good example of that. If you go back to last October, one short year ago, when we had the government shutdown, a budget would have been passed in a heartbeat had the Speaker allowed the budget to come to the floor and allowed it to be passed with both Republican and Democratic votes. It would have passed probably with 300 votes. But unfortunately, the Speaker is held captive or allows himself to be held captive by the Tea Party folks, the folks who have signed this pledge, no new taxes, no this, no that, and their mantra is no, no, no. I think that's where the situation is. Frankly, there's a whole lot of legislation that could be adopted with both Republican and Democratic votes, but the Speaker's not willing to let that happen.
You are a veteran, retired Major General, and I know Scott Air Force Base is very important to you. We've talked about that in the past. How big a threat do you think exists with regard to Scott's future and the fact that it may not have a future?
Well, Don, I think what we really need to look at are several factors. First of all, I, as you know, I sit on the House Armed Services Committee, and I was a very strong advocate and voted with the majority to prevent any BRAC from happening, Base Realignment and Closure Commission, from happening for the next 2 years. And we were successful in implementing that. So that clearly gives us a two-year grace period. And the secret to Scott, really, is the fact that it is a huge headquarters base. It is rapidly developing a very strong cyber presence. I was very pleased about 8 weeks ago to announce that 320 new military folks, cyber warriors, are coming in to do cybersecurity, two new squadrons at Scott Air Force Base. Scott has 41,000 miles of fiber optic cable under that base. That's a huge benefit. And, you know, I'll bet you or someone you know has had your credit card hacked or your email account hacked or your debit card account hacked. I'll bet every listener out there either has had it happen to them or has had it happen to a friend. And so these kind of cyber attacks, whether they're coming from criminals or whether they're coming from foreign nations, adverse actors, we have to be on the lookout. It's absolutely unbelievable the number of attacks that happen every day on our computer infrastructure in this nation. So I think Scott has a great future in working towards that. Of course, the 126th Air National Guard Refueling Wing is there as well, which was under my command when I was the commanding general, the adjutant general of the National Guard in Illinois. And we will continue to work to get KC-46 tankers. That's the new tanker from Boeing. Those tankers are going to be purchased over the next 20 years, and there will be 146 of them purchased, somewhere between 150 and 170 of those purchased in the next 20 years. So while Scott was not in the first tranche or the first quota of those to come, most of those went to training bases. You've got to train them before you can fly them. I think that Scott will be in a good position to pick up more planes later on.
I'm not sure I understand how Scott can be effective in the cyber world that you're talking about and having our credit cards hacked.
Well, that was kind of an example of the intrusions that happened.
Well, let's talk about what Congress can do about that. Clearly, it's a problem, and you're right. Most people have had some experience with that. What can you do on Capitol Hill to correct this problem?
Well, what we have to do is adequately fund the folks who are working to stop this. And we have to ensure that government agencies cooperate with corporations. Boeing has had their computers hacked. And those are defense secrets. And we know where that hacking is coming from. So Congress needs to adequately fund the response and the counter response to that. When Congress fails to set aside the sequester, when Congress fails to adopt a budget that adequately provides for national defense, and you know, whether it's airplanes or computers or the CDC to ensure that we're getting the research done into the Ebola virus, Congress has to step up to the plate and ensure that we're not following this mindless sequester where we just slash everything 10% across the board.
Mm-hmm. We, in the discussion earlier with Mr. Bost, we talked about climate change, and he does not believe necessarily that this, in fact, is happening. Do you?
Oh, well, I think climate change is obviously happening. All you have to do is take a look at the photographs from space, and you can see the Arctic ice cap shrinking. We've seen this dramatic increase in floods and in hurricanes and in typhoons, and so I don't think there's any question that climate change is a fact.
Well, he disputes that science agrees on that.
Well, Mr. Bost is welcome to his opinion.
Well, the reason that came up is because we've had some emails from listeners, agricultural people, farmers in your district, who are concerned about it and concerned to the point that yields may soon be dropping as a result of the conditions prompted by climate change. What is the role of government? If this happens, what would the role of government be for these farmers?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting topic because I've talked to the farmers about that, and we see today corn being grown further north than it's ever been grown. It's growing in North Dakota. It'll be growing in Canada, and that's due to two reasons. One is the new hybrids. The other reason is because of the longer growing season due to climate change. So you may see productivity drop in some places, while you see increased productivity of some crops in other places. I would hesitate to say that you're going to see a drop in corn yields nationwide, but clearly it could happen in various locales depending on what happens with the climate.
And the role of government in providing some sort of financial relief for farmers if something like this does happen or begin to happen?
Well, you know, I, as you know, Don, I sit on the House Agriculture
That's
Committee.
That's why I'm asking,
And, of course, I sit on the House Agriculture Committee because of the importance of agriculture to the district and indeed to the nation and the world. As part of the farm bill that we just adopted, which is the first five-year farm bill adopted since 2007 and long overdue, we made several changes in the crop insurance program to make it less costly to the taxpayer. So we're saving the taxpayer money, while at the same time we're making it more responsive to the market and to farmers' needs. So we will certainly continue with those crop insurance programs so that we provide a floor for the agriculture for farmers.
I have to bounce around on some of our issues here because the time is somewhat limited, but as a major general, I'm curious as to what your thoughts are with regard to what's going on now with our ISIS forces in Syria and Iraq and what we should be doing about it.
Well, Don, you know, I think with ISIS, clearly we cannot allow a terrorist element like this to control large swaths of territory. We saw what happened in Afghanistan when we went in late 2001, early 2002, and deposed the government, but didn't maintain a presence there And as a result, Al-Qaeda established training grounds and so on. So we cannot allow ISIS or ISIL to control huge swaths of territory in the Middle East. The good thing that we see happening now is that the Arab League, the nations surrounding that, have realized the same thing and are coming to the conclusion that they're going to have to step in. You know, it's when you have American boots on the ground, particularly in nations in the Middle East, we're intruders. We're not of their culture. And I think the folks on the ground really need to be people from that area. Now, having said that, I can tell you that when I was a general and frequently in Central Europe or at NATO meetings, the refrain that I would always hear is that the U.S. is the indispensable partner. You know, and we are. We're the glue that holds any coalition together because we have the backbone. We have the logistics backbone. We have the intelligence. We have the refueling capabilities that no other nation in the world has. So I think that we probably, I think that what we need to do is provide those capabilities in support of what the Arab League is going to join together to do to control the situation on the ground.
But no boots on the ground for U.S. Forces.
I think we would have to have a clear and present danger to the security, to the national security of the United States before we put boots on the ground. Now, having said that, I can also tell you that the situation on the Turkish border is very concerning because Turkey, of course, is a NATO partner. And as a NATO partner, Article 6 of the NATO Treaty requires all NATO nations to support any NATO nation that is attacked. So if Turkey were to invoke Article 6 of the NATO treaty, we'd be required by our treaty obligations to intervene. Now, and frankly, we could not afford to disavow that obligation. We would have to assist Turkey in that. If we were to disavow the NATO obligation under Article 6, it would destroy any confidence whatsoever. So is it possible it could happen? Of course.
We could be sucked into something over there.
We could. And, you know, Don, if we could back up just one second to the ag question you asked me. I'm very proud of my work on the Agriculture Committee and certainly very proud also of the fact that the Illinois Farm Bureau has endorsed me for re-election because of my work on the Farm Bill and in the agriculture community.
Well, as long as we're backing up, let's back up to coal. And, you know, the role that it plays and the environmental crisis that many people feel that we are facing and will continue to face. What about that? Illinois coal is dirty.
Well, Don, you know, we've made tremendous strides in cleaning up Illinois coal. And let me say at the onset that I'm very proud to have the endorsement of the United Mine Workers for re-election also because of my work supporting the coal industry. But let's look at it this way. All right. 40% of the electric power nationally is generated by coal. In Missouri, it's over 90%. In Illinois, it's over 40%. Now, I don't think anybody would want to turn that coal off tomorrow. You couldn't afford to. We don't have the backup capacity. What happens this winter if you take 90% of the power in Missouri offline? The other thing is that people don't realize, here in Illinois, we today are mining more coal with fewer miners than we did 10 years ago. That's because of increased productivity. That coal's not being burned in Illinois. That coal is being loaded onto barges, shipped down the Mississippi River, and sent overseas where it's being burned overseas. I think what we need to do, and it's being burned overseas in countries like Pakistan or China or where they don't have solid environmental regulation. So what we need to do is develop the research and the technology, drive the technology costs down. You all know what happens with computers. You know, the price keeps getting driven down as it gets better. So let's get that technology cost down to the point where not only can we use it effectively and efficiently in this country, but we can ship that overseas. Because those countries aren't going to stop burning coal. And you know, that air circulates around the globe. So we need, all of us want clean air, clean water for our children to breathe and to drink. And I think the answer to the problem is to develop the research and technology that we need to have to ensure that that's clean coal.
And how close are we to that?
I think we're very close. You know, the coal mining folks come in and chat with me, and They'd like to have 20 years to get there. I think we can probably drive it faster. I'm not a scientist or a technology guru, but I know what you put research and development into, you succeed at. You know, we've certainly seen that in Silicon Valley and lots of other places.
I want to take a quick call. Again, our time is limited, but I want to bring Dennis from Overland in. But Dennis, it has to be very, very quick.
Okay, yes. I just wanted to point out with what's going on with the Ebola and antivirus and things like that, the quicker that we get everybody health care in this country, and for that matter, the world, the better off we're going to be. It doesn't do you any good to have your neighbor's house on fire. It doesn't make my house look better.
All right, Dennis.
So, and the nannies and limousine drivers, those people, if they don't have health care, wealthy people will have sickness. Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Well, Don, if I could add something to that. Dennis, I think we all need to be aware, too, that the CDC's budget topped out in 2010, and in the current fiscal year, that the CDC, because of the Republican cuts, the budget has been cut 10%. The National Institute of Health, the CDC, of course, is the Center for Disease Control. The NIH, the National Institute of Health, likewise, budget topped out in 2010, and today it's been cut. And if the Paul Ryan budget were to be adopted, the budgets of each of those tremendous research institutions and healthcare providers would be cut by 24% over the next 10 years.
I've got to leave it at that. Unfortunately, we don't have more time, but I want to thank you, Bill Lanier, for being with us. Good luck on November 4th. And we'll ask our audience to join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with Broadway star Karen Mason about her Gaslight Cabaret Festival appearance and with pianist Long Long about his performance at the St. Louis Symphony's Red Velvet Ball. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with the Constitution Party candidate for St. Louis County Executive Joe Passanisi. We'll also take a look at a program in which inmates at the women's prison in Vandalia, Missouri, train service dogs. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.